Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. And welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today we're talking to Dr. Wajma Osman, who is the author of the book Television and the Afghan Culture Wars, brought to you by Foreigners, Warlords, and Activists, published by the University of Illinois Press. Dr. Osman, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Reagan, for having me.
Great. I'm so glad that you are here on the show with us to talk about your book. And so we'd like to begin by just asking people, how did you come to write this book? Can you tell us about yourself, you know, your background and what sparked your interest in media in Afghanistan?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from Afghanistan, and when the Soviet invasion happened, we became refugees in Pakistan. So then we lived in Pakistan for 4 years, and then I immigrated to the U.S. We all, well, minus my father, he stayed behind, but the rest of us came here when I was 10 to the States, mostly the Northeast. I always maintained my cultural ties and tried to maintain my cultural fluency. And my father was there, and I have other family there, so I would go back and forth. And so after 9/11, there was a big spotlight on Afghanistan because, you know, the thought at the time was that Afghans were responsible for 9/11. I mean, since then, it's been complicated, of course, with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and so forth. But at the time, I remember there was so much misinformation in the media that was circulating in the public. And most of the discourse, or I should say the dominant discourse at the time in the media, including from academic experts, was categorizing Afghanistan as despotic, people who are tribal, militant, extremely misogynist, things like that. And that's not to say that those elements don't exist, but I had seen from my own lived experiences that there was so much creativity and progressive movements and reform work being done over there. And so that was really what sparked my initial interest, because it was shortly thereafter 9/11 that I started my master's program in Middle Eastern studies. And I was thinking about how to rectify some of these stereotypical notions of Afghans in Afghanistan that was having real world discriminatory consequences for Afghan Americans living here.
Great. And so I wanted to begin talking about the book by talking about the title. And so the book is called Television and the Afghan Culture Wars, as I already said, brought to you by foreigners, warlords, and activists. And so what are the Afghan culture wars? And what do the debates, I guess, with these culture wars revolve around?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm actually surprised no one's asked me that before. But I was very deliberate in titling the book, and putting the word culture wars in the title of the book, because one thing I realized through my academic graduate training was that the way that Western history and ideas of democracy and nation building are written is very different than the way that the discourses around or the dominant narratives around the global South and the global East are written. It's like in my both master's and PhD work, I learned about all the different democratic formations that the West had invented and built upon, from glorifying settler colonialism to Habermas's cafe culture in Europe and so forth. And when I looked more closely at it, many of those projects were exclusionary and racist and sexist and so forth. But yet, Western academics would draw the kernels of it that had the potential for democracy and pluralistic society and for, better human rights. But in the East and in the South, that the same type of thing was not happening. And so, I have my book with me. I'll read one part that I specifically talk about this. And I say, the dominant image of Afghanistan as forever static and unchanging is so ingrained and rigidly fixed in the minds, policies, and theories of Western technocrats that there is no room for deviance or stretch of the imagination from these perceived notions. Thus, the history and present of Afghanistan cannot be seen on a continuum of change or swinging pendulum of culture wars, like Western countries are afforded, even during brutally extreme repressive governments. And so I really wanted to focus on this idea that, culture is not static and fixed, and places like Afghanistan are not stuck in time or frozen in time or backwards, as they're oftentimes said, but that there are people historically and in the present who have been fighting for progressive change.
Yeah, thank you. So that leads to basically the next question about people like the non-static nature of culture and the people who have been fighting for progressive change, because in chapter one, you recount this history of nation building projects undertaken by the Afghan government, and then you also talk about these imperial projects that intervened within these, nation building projects. And you include a particular period from the 1950s to the 1970s, when the Afghan government was sending college students away for study abroad and was employing men and women to work for the government and build a nation. And you tell this story through a personal lens of your family. And so how did you decide to include your family background in the book, and how does your account disrupt dominant ideas of Afghan history and culture?
Yeah, so it wasn't an easy decision to include my personal accounts, including my family's background and history, in these important historical moments in Afghan history. And partially that's because I've noticed that when you have lived experiences or you're a scholar from a certain region working on that region, that it's very easy for the dominant order or, institutional people to say that that people like us are not capable of being objective, right? That we're too steeped in it and too embedded in the culture to be able to zoom out and have that critical overview analysis that's needed in good scholarship. And I actually entirely disagree. And I think more research into the scientific method has shown that it was never objective to begin with, that people always bring their perspectives. And so I wanted to be transparent about that. And that also has to do with my mentor, mentor and PhD advisor, Faye Ginsburg, among other committee members who are revisionist anthropologists who believe that you bring your embedded knowledge into something and you're transparent about that. And so that's why ultimately I decided that even though on the one hand it's a academic study where I went into the archive and researched these historical moments, that at the same time it was going to be only provide more of a rich description if I brought in the experiences of my parents and my aunts and uncles who took part in the women's movement and civil rights movements and human rights movements that was happening from the 50s through the 70s in a way similar to what was happening in this country.
And so in your book, you're really, one of the cases that you're making is for ethnography of media and ethnography as a research method and helping to discern the role and effects of media in the context of development. And so you write on page 57, and so I'm going to quote you, as a result of the destruction of many of its institutions, such as its media, arts, education, and museums, contemporary Afghanistan is culturally and nationally speaking particularly vulnerable and unsettled. After four decades of war and instability, Afghanistan will remain in a state of perpetual war. End the quote. And so I was wondering if you could talk about conducting ethnography in this context, and if you could give us a sense of, you know, what you ended up doing with your ethnography, like who did you speak with, what television stations did you visit, and how did the unsettled conditions from war affect your research?
Yeah, that's a great question and a big question, too. So I'll start with the quote that you just read about how Afghanistan is culturally and nationally speaking particularly vulnerable and unsettled. And that's partially why I use the framework or the conceptual theories of cultural imperialism in the book as well, because on the one hand, I think it's great that Afghanistan's media system has media from all around the world, right? So you can access 50, at any time, at least 50 television channels completely for free, and have access to media from the West, from Turkey to the bordering countries, from reality TV to dramatic serials and soap operas to call-in shows, music videos, everything from everywhere. And I think that's terrific because it gives a window for Afghans on the world. But on the other hand, it's also important for Afghans, and this is something I learned through my ethnographic interviews, it's very important for people to develop a sense of what Afghan culture is. And after so many years of war, we lost so many talent to people being either killed in the wars or to dying of old age or becoming refugees elsewhere, since, more than a half of the country became refugees. And so you know, one of the things that media producers stressed to me was the importance of original productions as well. And sometimes it's difficult for them to do that because it's so much cheaper to buy these subsidized, import these cultural products from other places. And then to the second part of your question about what's it like to do, conduct ethnographic research in essentially a war zone. You know, many people say it's a post-conflict area, but it really, in many ways, is active with suicide bombings and international military campaigns and so forth. I mean, we'll see what the next, phases for Afghanistan with Biden's plans to withdraw the troops. The simple answer is that was very challenging and difficult. I mean, ethnographic work in general, I think, is challenging. As you know, yourself, a ethnographer, you're leaving one home behind and you're trying to acclimate to another environment for a long duration of time, which is never easy. And then on top of that, in an environment where there's so much precarity and security problems and issues, it's doubly challenging. And so I think as an Afghan American, at times it became confusing in terms of my own identity, because I had to very much, as much as possible, acclimate and try to assimilate for survival reasons. And so sometimes it was like, oh, who am I? You know, amidst all of the other research I was trying to do. But, you know, ultimately, I commend the people in Afghanistan, and particularly my interlocutors and the subjects of my study, who are media makers in Afghanistan and reformers and human rights activists who, take great risks every day in order to move the culture forward in a very dangerous environment. And a number of people that I interviewed have since then either been targets of attacks or have been killed. And so, you know, the challenges to me were nothing compared to them. And it's been a devastating aspect of my research to have known these people and see what they go through.
Thank you. And so also with the book, obviously the book is about media in Afghanistan. And so you're making this case for global media and what we can learn outside of the United States or maybe outside of the global North context. And so in my own research, it intersects with media and communication studies. And one thing I learned in that field was that media studies tends to be dominated by media in the United States and Europe. You push back on this in several ways. But one of the ways you push back is in thinking about how media is funded. And you show us this very active media sphere, which is funded partially through development in Afghanistan. So how is the media sphere in Afghanistan funded, and how does this add to our understanding of the political economy of media?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. I have an entire chapter on questions of political economy. As we both know in our work, it's very important to track where the funding comes from, because it does have a bearing and usually a great impact on content and ideology and what type of cultural influence the media is going to have. And so maybe the short way of answering it without getting into the details of all the different funding streams is that what I ultimately argue is that because Afghanistan is not unilaterally under the influence or receives media from just one country, namely the U.S., but in reality, it the media proliferation is such that it's very international in scope. And so there's media, both actual media products and media funding coming internationally from all over the world that enables it to have more of a public interest model, meaning that there's active competition between the different media venues. And there's so many different media venues that the truth can ultimately, there can be really rich debates and truthful conversations about things versus a highly commercial model, which is more monopolistic and promotes the ideologies of just one of, a dominant country. And in many ways, the U.S. itself has a highly corporatized and monopolistic media environment. And that's what it usually exports to countries. And so in this respect, Afghanistan has been lucky that it has been able to counterbalance some of that media hegemony by building relationships with other countries.
Yeah, and that was really interesting to read in that chapter, where readers might be surprised by just the breadth and depth of media availability in Afghanistan. And so that was one of the things that I found to be particularly interesting as well. And that leads to the question of, I guess, what people might be actually watching in this media sphere. And so in the book, you take us into some of the programming of Afghans, of what they might be watching. And I was struck by your statement, I remember underlining it, that the news is one of people's favorite programs. And you also mentioned that on the news, they show quite a bit of violence with the objective of bringing about peace. And, this struck me as different from an assumption in the United States, which is that, showing violence will lead to more violence. And so why is the news so popular? And how can we think about this showing violence that can lead to peace?
Yeah, so I think I'll start by saying that the news, you're absolutely right, the news is very popular. But part of my argument also is that that doesn't take away from how important a function, less serious programming and more entertainment programming in a war zone serves. And so it's one does not negate the other. Afghans love the news, and they also really need to have this more entertainment programming to offset the trauma of living in a war zone. But the news is important because down to just giving very basic information on what areas to avoid because a suicide bomb has gone off or there's U.S. military activity over here for people to stay away from it. So it really can mean not just learning about the world and learning about the policies of the international community in the U.S. and what it has in mind for the future of Afghanistan, which dictates much of what happens over there, but also just on an everyday level, just the difference between surviving and not surviving is so attached to getting that kind of information from the news. And so every channel has news, and then most of the news programming tries to be as accurate as possible and not to disseminate misinformation or disinformation campaigns as we have here, partly because if they do, there's so many other outlets that will provide different information, and then those stations that aren't providing the full story or the true story will be shamed in many ways. And so to your question of how that leads to showing a great deal of violence, that was something I noticed right away. And in the U.S., we don't have violence in the news for a variety of reasons. Partially what you said is there's this assumption that showing violence will lead to more violence. But partially it's because we have, as I said before, a highly commercial media system, which believes that people should always be in a buying mode, right? So in a shopping mode, and that seeing realistic violence on the news is going to turn people away. And so in Afghanistan, I think to put it shortly, you know, I've written extensively on the impacts of violent imagery and you know, what the consequences of that are. But I think to put it more simply, I think the fact that they put an air unedited real world violence relating to war, both from the international military presence as well as Afghan on Afghan sectarian violence, has the impact of turning people against war. And that's something, and against violence more generally. And that's something that happened here as well historically with the Vietnam War, which is called the first televisual war. It's what spurred the anti-war movement. And the difference here is that when you see violence, it's a Hollywood violence that's very glorified. And so when you have glorified and sensationalistic violence, then these young kids and, you know, teenage boys, and that's why we have so much gun violence here, watch it. And it just seems like there's, you know, it's glorified. It seems like fun type of thing to do, to have these semi-automatic weapons, versus over there you see the aftermath. They show when a bomb goes off or somebody gets shot, like they show the blood and the people crying and the people calling for help. And it's completely different experience, and it was something I was not used to seeing. You know, you're watching TV, you're having dinner, you're watching the news, and you don't see that in the U.S., but you see that there. And I can see why it has that effect of bringing about peace versus more violence. But I think there's more studies to be done on that.
And so the role of women also seems to be central in your work. And so both representations of women and the work of women in the media as reporters and show hosts, as well as audiences. And so I'm kind of simplifying this a little bit, but it appears that the role of women is also tied to the Afghan nation, where more sort of conservative forces may wish to see women at home and more progressive forces may wish to see women have the choice to work. And then there's also like added pressure from outside of the country with these attempts to quote unquote save Afghan women. But all of this attention to women seems to put them in a very vulnerable position and render them like more vulnerable to violence. And so can you expand on this role of women? How do women's issues intersect with Afghan media and what vulnerabilities do they face?
Yeah, so the role of women and gender and sexuality more broadly was something that was of great interest to me from the start, because partially saving Afghan women was used as a justification post 9/11 to start the military operations that have now led to what's been dubbed as the Forever War. I think in October, we're going to celebrate the 20th year anniversary of the U.S.'s longest war in Afghanistan. And so from the start, I wanted to turn the dialogue about women's rights back to Afghans themselves. And that was partially why I chose television, because television is such an important medium. And so many of the debates about women's role in society and women's rights, and the debates that you mentioned between more conservative groups and Islamists and more progressive groups, as well as the outside forces who also have this agenda of saving women, were all happening through the media, in particular broadcast media. I think one of the things that I noticed, or one of the takeaways that I had through my ethnographic research, is that the programs that were more didactic, especially supported by Western funding about women's rights, that focused on issues like domestic violence, you know, some traditional misogynist practices, you know, issues of child brides, honor killings, all types of other prevalent problems there currently, were not as popular as some of the other programming that was produced by Afghan women themselves. And audiences wanted to see more of that, which had women in more in roles where they had more agency. So one of the programs I talk about, which is actually film in the film sector, is Saba Sahar, who has her own film franchise, and she plays women, heroine characters, like a traditional horseback riding warrior. And she's the one that's saving Afghanistan, right? So she plays as part of a police officer. She herself is also a police officer in the Afghan police there. Other things I noticed is that in dramatic serials, sometimes the villainesses or the villainous female characters who rebelled against the heteronormativity of the protagonist couple were also very popular. And then I also had the opportunity to be invited to the Homo Social Theater Worlds, and where there's a lot of gender play and cross-dressing and things like that. And so in those types of other formats, Afghan women were able to imagine themselves in ways that gave them hope and inspiration, as opposed to just further dictating to them their reality. So that was one of the things that I noticed. And aside from that, there's so many incredible people in the media sphere and in the human rights sphere who, from lawyers to members of parliament to, you know, journalists who are doing such incredible work that I think, you know, Western institutions need to defer to when they're working on gender policy over there.
So absolutely. And so you already spoke about the news media and its importance. And you said it, you know, it doesn't take away from the fact that people might want other forms of entertainment as well, or, you know, other kinds of programs to watch in the, you know, in the media sphere. And so you talk about consumption in the book as well. So it was interesting. The book, it talks about, you know, political economy, the production of media, and then as well as like a reading of media texts, and then also consumption of media. So you get a very full look into the media sphere in Afghanistan. And I think that's something that, you know, ethnographic work, I think, as you mentioned, can really, you know, can really show us. And so you look into consumption and you include the audience responses to the media. And I think this is in the last chapter of the book. And one thing you note is the popularity of Indian soap operas or dramas. And so I was wondering what you made of this popularity of Indian soap operas or programming in the Afghan media sphere.
Yeah, I mean, I think with soap operas as a genre more broadly, before I delve into Indian soap operas, is that it's been highly stigmatized in the West, and media studies have shown that it's also been gendered female or feminized in many respects, right? So similar to rom-coms and other genres. You know, there's people who are like, oh no, I would never watch soap operas, or I would never watch rom-coms because, you know, that's what, you know, bored housewives do, or all these other kinds of stigmas that we have about it. But in reality, in the rest of the world, and I think that's why it's important to have a sense of global media, which we don't really in this country, because the media is very exclusionary and keeps so much international media very intentionally out of the venues and channels here in the US. But in reality, what I was saying is that in much of the rest of the world, dramatic serials, which is another way of calling soap operas, is very popular across genders. And it's not something that's stigmatized. And partially that's because, and this goes to the case of Afghanistan in your question about Indian soap operas, I think partially it's because everyone can relate to the domestic stories, right? So they're very much about family life and family stories and things that happen with siblings, things that happen with parents and with in-laws, and you know, things that we can all relate to. And so for and especially in Afghanistan, where kinship networks are very important, I think in a way we live in a more individualistic society where some of those bonds are not as important here. But there, people that I interviewed, and I interviewed men and women who are avid fans of international soap operas. Everybody watches them. And, you know, the Indian and Turkish ones tend to be most popular across my interviews. And so I think partially it was also because it was a way of enabling them, giving them the space to talk about their own domestic issues and challenging some of their gender roles and things like that through what they saw on screen, their favorite characters being able to challenge some of these, you know, patriarchal practices and so forth. And that gave them the courage to bring up those issues in their lives.
And so I wanted to move a bit from the book to talk about, I guess, your work as a professor. And so you not only do research on global media, but you teach about it as well. And so I was just wondering how you bring these insights from the book into your classroom. What kinds of media might you, you know, might you include in your classes?
I mean, I think it's challenging because the way we've been trained in the U.S. or socialized, I should say, as American citizens is in a sense of exceptionalism at times, right? So that the whole world revolves around us and that other people need to pay attention to our media, but we don't necessarily need to pay attention to other people's media or news or lives or culture as much. And, you know, I don't need to go into the reasons behind that. I think it's very complex and it's historically involved. But all that is to say that it is challenging to engage students and Americans more generally to take an interest in global media and the lives of people from other countries more broadly. And I think maybe that'll shift because we have more immigrants from other parts of the world coming into the U.S., which, of course, immigration policy is an issue in of itself here. And then you have the global refugee crisis, where I think Afghanistan is once again number one in the most refugees. I think Syria was number one before. And so to your question of how I engage people in it is I try to remind people about the importance of having a sense of media and people from other places, because it really does open up a whole new world to them. And we can understand people so much better sometimes than we understand them through the talking head experts that we see on the news, versus watching their programming and their media. And in certain ways, I think the online screening platforms have been doing a better job of exposing people to it. But I think these are challenging questions. I have one friend who says that when you talk about people and places from other places in the world, from other parts of the world, that American people, their eyes just kind of glaze over, which is such a shame, because the world is a very diverse and beautiful place. And every place, as you know, you work in Brazil and in South America, every place has so much to offer and so many things we can learn from.
No, absolutely. And to your point about the sort of limitations of the U.S. media sphere, I always think about that when I'm in Brazil, because the media sphere there is just is much more diverse. And so I could go to a film and go to a movie theater and a film from Sweden is playing or something, of course with subtitles. But, if I was, and I always am reminded, if I was in the US, I would never even know that that film existed, because generally in our mainstream movie theaters, that film would not be, being screened. So I'm always, I'm always reminded of that as, when I'm there. And so you also not only, teach about film and media, but you're also a filmmaker. And you shot a documentary called Postcards from Tora Bora. And so I was wondering if you could talk about the film and if it relates to the book in any way.
Yeah, I think the two do speak to themselves, to one another, the film and the book. And I was a filmmaker and a journalist and worked in the American media sector before I went to academia. And the film started as what we were trying to do is a documentary on women's rights post 9/11, and to assess whether the U.S. interventions that were based on saving Afghan women and improving conditions there had actually done that. And then somehow along the way, once we received feedback from audiences were gravitating more towards the personal stories. So it became a personal narrative and a personal documentary. And so it is a trajectory of my family's experience becoming refugees, and also the impact of war, not just on my family, but more broadly, and the cost of what it does to people's lives and so forth. And so in that respect, it has a direct thread to the book, which also there's no way of avoiding war, sadly, when you're talking about Afghanistan, because it's part of the present and the recent past, and its impact is profound on people's lives.
Absolutely. So we've taken up enough of your time, and I wanted to thank you for sharing your work with us. And just as a final question, now that the book is out, I was wondering if you are working on any new projects now. And then I realize I'm asking this question in the midst of a pandemic and other upheaval. And so, if it's not projects you're working on now, do you have other projects or ideas that are on the horizon that you're thinking about?
Yeah, I do have other projects. As you said, I think the pandemic has taken a toll on all of us. I think, it has impacted our production in that way. But one of the things I'm thinking about currently is relates to a question you asked earlier, which is about the impact of showing violence on television and violent imagery more broadly, whether it's cell phones or YouTube or so forth. And I'm thinking about, and I've been working on a comparative project, trying to connect the ways that racism and violent imagery work in this country with the ways that it works in the MENISA countries, so the Middle East, North Africa, South Asia, around interviewing people and their reactions to watching different types of violent imagery and whether that creates more empathy or antipathy. And here I'm also trying to learn and study up on African-American scholarship, which has written extensively on these issues of whether it's antebellum violence or other types of violence presently with Black Lives Matter and how that impacts movement. So I'm trying to see the link between empathy and social movements as a result of showing more realistic violence. And I have one article published from that, which is called Agents and Villains of the Security State, but I'm expanding it and trying to conduct some more ethnographic research around that.
Wow, that sounds really, really interesting and timely research and very, very important. So we'll look out for that as well. So I've been speaking with Dr. Wajma Osman, the author of Television and the Afghan Culture Wars, brought to you by Foreigners, Warlords, and Activists, published by the University of Illinois Press. And so thank you for writing this book, and thank you for sharing it with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Reagan, for having me.